You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby G and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to the Hot Texas Swing Band with our buddy Alex Dormont, and the name of that tune was Hot Texas.
Yes. So,
what's going on?
Who are our guests tonight?
That's the question.
That's always the question at the top of the hour. Well, we are excited to have two guests with us tonight. In the second half of the show, not with us quite yet, standing by our authors, Preston Lewis and Harriet Coker Lewis, and they'll be taking center stage. And right now, let's welcome our first guest, author Jan DePayne, in the limelight with Jan. Welcome, Jan.
Hi, Jan.
We're delighted to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Where are you joining us from?
I am in north central Minnesota.
And have you had snow yet?
Not yet, but usually by Thanksgiving, if it's a normal year.
Yeah. We had some the other day, which is kind of surprising for us.
And it really, you know, it melted within a couple of hours, but oh my goodness, power out, limbs down, slow traffic, all the, you know, we don't know how to drive in snow in Albuquerque.
I read about that.
Well, we're going to be talking with Jan about her new book, Rabbit Moon. And to get us started, Jim has a little bio.
We have a little bio here. Jan DePayne, drawing from her years in the Southwest and on the Navajo Nation, Jan DePayne writes using themes of courage, regret, hope, and restoration in a world of kinships within differing cultures. She attributes an early entrance in writing to a wealth of family stories, including that of a great-great aunt taken captive by Comanche Kiowa raiders in 1870s Texas. She is a member of Western Writers of America and Women Writing the West. She and her husband, John, live in northern Minnesota. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So this is for our readers and author friends that are joining us tonight. This is a thrilling mystery thriller ride, and it'll grab you from page one. There were many times I was holding onto the edge of my seat, and Jim would look over at me and say, "Breathe, honey. I think you need to breathe." Just a fabulous book. So, Jan, tell us a little bit about what inspired Rabbit Moon.
Growing up on the reservation, I guess, is what inspired it. I mean, I think you write about the things that you know and the places that you're from, the people that you were around. And that's where I lived on the Navajo Reservation. So,
and
you have a medical background, right?
Yes, I do.
So, when did you start writing?
I started writing pretty much full time after I retired, and I didn't retire from medicine until 2013. So, but I've always written. Since I was a little kid, I mean, I wrote stories all the time.
you take us, I think most all readers, we love to follow the author on the ride, wherever the author is taking us. And we hope that we can trust the author right at the start so that we know that wherever we go, we're going to have a really interesting journey. And I found with this book, Jan, that you also share quite a bit of, I guess I'll say, Navajo culture and the differences for those of us that are not of the culture. I really enjoyed how you without you taught us and shared lots of different vision and how things are perceived and the difference through the eyes of your main character, Marin, and then the people that she comes in contact with. What is the Rabbit Moon?
The Rabbit Moon, when I came up with that title, it was mostly to give a sense of the differences in the two cultures. Like when I moved there, all the things that I didn't know and the things that were new. And on the reservation, and I'm sure in many other places too, it's a rabbit in the moon, not a man in the moon. So if you look at the full moon, it's almost a full moon outside lately. You'll see a rabbit. The two ears are pointing up towards the top and the little body and feet are down at the bottom. So that inspired the title. And there's, lots of mythology around the rabbits and rabbits and animals, creatures in general. So that's where the title came from.
Mm-hmm. Is the rabbit in the moon, is that a good sign when you see that, or is that a something to worry about?
It's just sort of is. It definitely means the moon is full because you don't see it unless, the moon is full. So everything that in our culture goes along with the full moon, it kind of goes along with the full moon in other cultures too, only it's a rabbit, not a man in the moon.
There's a little conversation early on between Marin and Vanjie. And am I saying her name right, Vanjie?
Yes.
And they're talking about the Rabbit Moon. And one of them talks about how the first day of the month before you say anything, you say rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. And that's actually a tradition in my family. I've heard
really?
That.
For
as long, yes. And sometimes my sister will text me. She's in Illinois. She'll text me on the first day of the month and she'll, to be sure that if that's the first thing I'm reading or saying. So I thought that was so fun that you included it. And of course, you share that it's not Navajo lore. It's, it's part
not
of.
Not that I know of. It was in my family. And I texted to my kids too at the first of the month and my husband. And no, I don't know of any culture, Navajo culture for sure. But
yeah.
Well, Vanjie said. That she read it, she said.
Yeah, she does.
So,
Jan, when I first heard this one morning, Bobby, all I hear out of her mouth is rabbit.
Rabbit.
Is there a rabbit in the house?
Rabbit, rabbit, rabbit.
Not knowing that this is a good luck saying,
Well, you're supposed to ensure that you have a good month. Yes, absolutely.
Yep,
rabbit's on your side.
That's what they say.
Yeah. There are some other things that you weave into the story. For instance, the North. There are some thoughts about the North within the Navajo culture, and also in the Hogan, the North Wall. I think if there's been a death in the Hogan, do you want to just share a little bit about that with our listeners?
In Navajo culture, the directions east, west, north, and south all have a significance. And the creation story, the Navajo creation story, has a lot to do with how the Hogan is built and who sits where. The front, the east door is the door. It always faces the east so that you see the morning sun when it comes up.
Mm.
The north is considered more or less the direction of evil. So that's the side that gets caved in. If somebody dies, you cave in the north wall. The other sides of the house, one side's the woman's side. Another side is mostly the male side. So there's a side for visitors. Everything's very prescribed, and they do it according to the creation myth. You'd have to read the whole creation story. So even the way you build the Hogan, is part of the creation story.
I really enjoyed how you weave all of these elements in. It's just part of the story. It's not like, okay, I'm going to teach you all something now. It's just the way that this story is told. I for one, really appreciated that. What do you hope readers will take away when they finish reading your books?
Well, like you said, I hope they take away a little bit of the culture. I don't I don't say that I am an expert on Navajo culture. I talk about and tell about a story about what I learned, where I lived. I'm not Navajo. My heroine, Marin, she is not Navajo. She's Anglo. But my favorite books are books that surprise me, or they give me a very satisfied feeling at the end, like I learned something, but I also read a really good, exciting story, and it had some twists and turns to it. That's what I hope people take away. And if you can come away with a little knowledge of a different culture, maybe one you didn't grow up with or one you're not familiar with, there's that too. You know, I like to learn things when I read books. I'm a curious person.
Yeah.
Could you give us a little bit of the storyline, story of the book, without necessarily giving away spoiler alerts?
Well, Marin Sinclair has left the reservation. She left years ago to go to college, and she never went back. You know, you end up working and your jobs and everything. She is an end-of-life doula, which means she cares for people at the end of their lives. And she's sort of a lost person. Her family is dead. She cared for her father until he died. She doesn't have a extended family, really. And she doesn't really have a home or a family or a place that she feels like she belongs. She had a very good friend in high school and all through her growing up life, Vanjie So. And Vanjie contacts her and says, I need you. Come see me. I need to see you. And so Marin goes back to see her, and from there it's all kinds of things happen. So
heart-wrenching and exciting, and we learned that Marin is a gal with a lot of gumption and very observant, and she just gets through a whole maze of obstacles and challenges that you put in her direction.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to ask your favorite question?
Oh, we got a couple questions, but we'll ask the one. Yeah. Your characters, did they ever surprise you?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, they surprised me a lot. I had an outline for this book years before I actually sat down and wrote it. And once you've developed people, they're people, and they have a mind of their own, and they've got their own characters. And there are some times when they surprise you by saying, no, I would never do that, or this wouldn't happen, or
don't kill me.
So, yeah, they do surprise you sometimes. You're like, well, I'm the author here. So.
Oh, Jan, this has been fun chatting with you. Tell us, what do you have coming up next?
Well, I'm working on book number two and book number three. Book number two is basically written. It just takes so long with the editing and everything to get it out. Hopefully that'll come out in 2025, and then hopefully the next year, number three. I don't know how far I'll go. We'll see how it works out.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how can we find you? How can our listeners and watchers out there find out?
I have a website, jandypayne.com. Very easy to remember. I have a website. I'm on social media, Facebook, Jan D. Payne, author. That's pretty much the way to find me.
We've been talking with Jan about Rabbit Moon. I'm holding it up one more time so you can see this beautiful cover. And Jan, we have somebody in common, don't we? We have Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. And they are sponsors of the show, and we absolutely love working with those ladies. I'm sure you do, too.
I do.
We're going to take a step away. We're going to hear a word from Blue Cottage. And, Jan, thank you so much. You get back in touch with us when the next one's ready.
Thank you.
So delighted to have you back on.
Thanks, Jan. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll be talking to Preston Lewis and Harriet Coker Lewis. Don't go away. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experience, trusted, effective.
Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Reminded with a Writer with our special guests, Harriet and Preston Lewis.
And we're going to be talking about all these fabulous books. A handful of, they need to be on your Christmas gift list. Handful of books. Hello. Hello. Where are you joining us from?
We're in San Angelo, deep in the heart of Texas.
All right.
Wonderful. Jim has a little bio for each of you he's going to just share, and then we're going to get right at it.
How far in Texas is San Angelo? Is that clear down to the border, or is that?
It's right in the middle.
It's right in the middle.
Right in the middle. Okay.
Okay. You draw an X across Texas. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I like to say it's where West Texas and the Hill Country collide.
Oh,
okay. We'll get an idea of where that is. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
What a wonderful location.
Okay. First bio is going to be yours, Preston. Multi award winning author Preston Lewis began his writing career in the newspaper world. Now, with 58 published books to his credit, he was inducted into the Texas Institute of Letters in 2021. We applaud to welcome past president of Western Writers of America and a fellow of the Texas Historical Association, Preston Lewis. All right, Preston, you got a really impressive bio.
58.
We just couldn't get
books.
It all in.
How do you write 58 books? Oh my goodness. No sleep.
Okay. Harriet Coker Lewis, with a science background. Harriet spent her career as a physical therapist. Being married to a writer rubbed off on her and led to her numerous editing and writing projects during her 15 years on the faculty of Angelo State University. With Preston, she has co-authored a number of books, including their most recent publication, Pint-Sized Pioneers, The Taming of the Frontier, One Chore at a Time. Welcome, folks. So nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How fun. We love to see the screen full of faces. That's really fun. So let's see. Let's talk about the new book. This was just released.
Pint-Sized Pioneers.
I'm going to hold it up again. Yeah. This was just released in September.
Correct.
And when we met you at the Western Writers Conference, very good. We got a duo going on. You knew that it was you pretty much had a release date. You knew what was happening. We're so excited to have you here so shortly after the release. So let's talk about this one first. Tell us a little bit about what inspired, how this book come about.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a family where work was valued. My father was a child of the Great Depression, and he was picking cotton before he ever set foot in the classroom in first grade. And so he instilled in my brother and me a work ethic, whether we wanted it or not. And that has served us very well. I mean, we've both been successful each in our own way, not necessarily because we were more talented than anybody else, but we worked and we worked hard based on what Dad did. And I guess the thing that concerned me in recent years, I've been seeing on TikTok and stuff, some of these younger kids complaining about having to go to work or being on time and having to do a job when there are more important things to do. And I just thought it would be interesting to compare what it was on the frontier in terms of what kids did and when they started work. And Harriet and I just found some of the most amazing things. I mean, one thing that attracted me to the project is we could research it together and then write on it. But man, we found things about kids that started working way earlier than you would imagine today, doing things that would probably get them sent to Child Protective Services if the law found out about it. And I think there was one quote in there that I think summed it up better than anything else in the book, that a man was writing to his brother, and Harriet has that quote.
Yes, Harriet.
In 1863, Kansas farmer Joseph M. Reed bragged to his brother about his young son. Little Bass can run all over, fetch up cows out of the stock fields or oxen, carry in stove wood, and climb in the corn crib and feed the hogs and go on errands to his grandma's. Little Baz was only 2 years and 3 months old at the time.
Well, that's starting early.
I remember reading that. I think I out underlined it too. It's like the lead is buried there when you see the age. I think I'm sure that I wasn't, I don't think I was doing anything at that age.
Yeah. You know, I kind of want to give you a compliment here on the book. You know, we've read a number of books by authors that have described things that went on in the West and children working on the farms or whether they're working on the ranches and some of the hardships they went through. But yours was the first book to actually put it together and address that directly. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of neat.
So, it was fun. Yeah. We enjoy history and we like some of the offbeat aspects of Old West history. So that's why we're in children and later into cats.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask, Bob and I got to talking after we talked to you. And I know you work, you know, you started work early. And I assume both of you did. When did you get, how old were you when you got your first paying gig as a kid? When did they first start paying you for picking cotton? Or did you ever get paid?
I never had to pick cotton. We lived on a small place in the country, so we did gardening and stuff like that. But my first job was at a lumber yard in Midland, Texas, and I think I got like $1.25 an hour for that during the summer.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I started babysitting and started earning money at age 10 babysitting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Did you get allowances or did you get paid? You know, if you polished the silver, you got something or, you know, was there compensation for the chores that you did?
Dad paid my brother and me 10 cents an hour. We were cheap labor.
Yeah. Well, no bunnies, right?
Yeah.
And Harriet, what did you say?
I had an allowance.
You had an allowance.
10 cents a week.
Yes.
10 cents a week.
I really don't remember how much. I do remember Saturdays was chore day. That was a day that everybody was doing chores at the house. And I remember one Saturday, I was probably 8 or 9, and my dad came into the bedroom. I was sitting on my bed reading, and he said, "Who do you think you are, the Queen of Sheba? We need you outside." And whenever you weren't doing what you should be, you were the Queen of Sheba.
Well, what we did was nothing compared to what those pioneer kids did.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. What do you want to give a couple of examples, other examples of what kids did from your research?
Well, they did pretty much everything that the adults did, just on a little smaller scale, depending on their age and size. So they tended the animals, they milked cows, they sewed, they mended clothes, they planted, they harvested, they collected firewood, they toted water. And one chore that they particularly seemed to dislike was churning. In fact, there's a quote from one young Oklahoma boy who said, "What a job that churn. The man who invented it must have been an ogre who hated children."
And the book also, because we're seeing it through what the children did, those pint-sized pioneers, but we're also getting a look at things that we maybe thought we knew about that we didn't necessarily, like fighting fire. And some of what happens when there's a fire. How did kids get involved in fighting a fire, say a prairie fire?
Well, it depended on their age. But if there was a prairie fire, and if they lived in woods, sometimes they'd have to fight fire as well. And so, you know, they'd take blankets out and try to beat it out, at least to save the house and so forth. If they had adequate water, they would farm, you know, carry buckets of water and so forth. But basically everybody had to get involved just to save the place. It was could be very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing I think that historians always try to put things mm-hmm. in perspective, and I think it's important to put the kids in perspective in that era. If you look at the census in 1850, the children 16 and under made up 47%, almost half of the nation's population. Now, a century later in 1950, and we're children of the 50s, that percentage was down to 27%. So it went from about 50% to 25% in 100 years. So on the frontier, the children were an important part of the labor force because they were necessary to help make ends meet and keep the family surviving and thriving where they could. So it's a very important part of frontier history and the contributions that they made.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we know what happens as they settle, but the whole beginning part where you talk about the journey west and the movement, whether they were on wagon or they were with hand carts, that was all very, very interesting. And some of the situations they would find themselves in, like suddenly being the head of household, for instance.
Right.
Is there anything from that overland experience you'd like to highlight?
Well, I just think that they carried a load, and I think it was a young girl that was walking. I think it was from Iowa to Utah. She was Mormon and said years later, "I walked every step of the way, much of the time carrying my little brother on my back."
I
think that sort of sums up the challenges and the types of things that they did. Yeah. I mean, they didn't get a lot of playtime, and because when they were walking, they'd be collecting firewood or buffalo patties, cow patties for fire, and then have to get water at rivers and stuff. So it was a difficult life.
Do you want? I can hear you.
Well, I got a couple. First one, did you do a lot of special research here for these background stories, or have you collected them over the years?
It's a little bit of both and so forth. I used a lot of secondary sources, but used a lot of primary sources, particularly with the old newspaper articles that you could find online through newspapers.com. And then Harriet was involved in pulling a lot of those together, and she was especially helpful looking at the what the women, the young girls did and so forth, because oftentimes they were overlooked and in many ways had it harder than the boys. And Harriet can explain that.
Yes. Tell us a little more about that, Harriet.
Well, the girls tended to be ones that they did both the women's work, and many times they did men's work too. And they plowed and planted. They tended animals. They shoveled manure. They picked cotton. You know what they, whatever needed to be done, and that the men were doing, the women were doing, along with their women's chores. And this is kind of a good illustration is when an Iowa farmer went to Chicago to adopt a child, and he and his wife were very specific. They wanted a girl, and the adoption agency tried to talk them out of it and say, no, you want a boy. They said, no, we want a girl. it's much easier to make a boy out of a girl than it is to make a girl out of a boy. And there are lots of instances of girls doing men's work, very few stories of the boys doing the girls' work.
Mm-hmm. So the women were really equipped if they found themselves alone, weren't they? Because they sort of knew how to do it all.
Yes.
Yeah, they had to learn to defend themselves as well and so forth. And in Texas and in some places in New Mexico in particular, after sundown, the women and some of the older girls would dress in men's clothing, slacks and shirts, just in case there were Indians. So they would think there were more men there to protect the home than there actually were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so smart. That was something that, you know, never occurred to me. And that's what this book just highlights, all kinds of things that we might think we're familiar with if we're any kind of an armchair historian. But you bring out so many details of things, just even water, the digging of wells, the challenges of getting, you know, do you want to talk? That's another huge topic, of course, in the West is water. Do you want to touch a moment about how kids got involved in water?
Sure, it was, you know, water is the, you know, is the fountain of life. So it was, of course, necessary. If they were lucky to live near a water course, a stream or a river, then they would tote water in buckets. If they lived farther away, then the family would load a wagon with barrels and drive to the nearest water course, fill those barrels up and come back home. And it was real labor intensive. I mean, and to show you how, in a sense, close we are to the frontier, my grandmother never lived in a house, and she died in 1943. She never lived in a house with running water and electricity. And that's just, you know, two generations removed from me.
A heartbeat ago.
Water also, particularly on the plains, was also a problem. I mean, you needed it to survive and you needed it for crops, but rains could destroy your house. And Harriet liked some of those stories about rains on the prairies and what the women had to do.
Just a few quick examples of what they had to do. There's their story of one woman who they lived in a sod house, and those were notorious for having leaky roofs. And she put the baby in a cupboard to protect the baby from the leaking water. And there's another story that of a woman who walked around her house with an umbrella. It was raining almost as hard inside as it was outside. And then once the rain stopped, they had to carry everything outside to let it dry out. So the kids were involved in that too.
Yeah, there's chores today or back then that we just have no concept of just because of how much further we've advanced.
Yeah, I know. If you thought today, if you said to anybody, an adult or a youngster, okay, you've got to get to the closest river, you know, to bring some water back. I don't even know where, you know, that'd be like miles from here.
It'd be tough for us to survive.
We would not make it. We would not make it.
We'd have to toughen up.
You talked a little bit about work ethic, and I think with 58 novels under your belt or books under your belt, Preston and Harriet, you've done editing and writing for years and years. You two definitely are the wonderful role model for work ethic. What would you say was one of the benefits for kids who lived through this time with these chores?
Well, I think first of all, it was just the teaching them one responsibility. They learned self-reliance and they got confidence because they could work and figure things out on their own. And so they were a big help to the family. And of course, that helped them later on. And they were a big help to the development of the country. You've got to understand in this period after the Civil War to the turn of the 20th century, those were the decades when America became the country that we know it today. First of all, they filled in the land and settled the land between the coasts. Was the rise of the railroads and modern transportation, the use of the telegraph and the beginning stages of modern communication, the development of the corporation and business as we know it. And so those were the sort of the macro picture, and these kids were making their contributions in the micro picture as well.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about pint-sized pioneers, Taming the Frontier, One Shore at a Time. This is the newest book that Preston and Harriet just published. It's a wonderful read, and I would highly recommend it on your holiday gift list, as well as the books we're going to talk about when we come back. We're going to step away for a moment and show you one of the places that you can order these books, as well as most all of the books from our Rendezvous with a Writer guests. And that is our Out West Shop page on the great affiliate bookshop.org. So stay tuned. And when we come back, if you like cats or don't, we've got two great books we're going to talk about. Stay tuned.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Our special guests, Preston Lewis and Harriet Lewis.
And I'm holding up, for those of you that are listening to the audio, I'm holding up two books that Preston released. Cat Tales of the Old West, Poems, Puns, and Perspectives on Frontier Felines. This is the book number one. This is book number one. And then he released more Cat Tales, book number two. This is a set. You need to get these as a set. More Cat Tales of the Old West, Triumphs, Trials, and Trivia of Frontier Felines. Two really, really interesting reads. Preston, how did this series come about?
By accident. was at the Western Writers meeting in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and we took a field trip to Fort Laramie. And on the trip, the docent of the historical guide said that cats on the Oregon Trail were more valuable than horses, mules, or oxen, which struck me sort of interesting, but wasn't that big a deal until another friend of mine, who is the editor of a journal on Old West history, turned to me and said, Preston, I want you to write a story about cats in the Old West. Well, we were on the bus, I started looking at Harriet and rolled my eyes, but you know, you don't turn down a paying gig. So I said, okay, and came home and started looking in my library. And I've got a fairly extensive library on Western Americana. And I found maybe six references in the indices of those books about cats. And I'm like, this is going to be an awful short article. And then I thought, well, let me check out newspapers.com, which has historical newspapers. And I put in the parameters states west of the Mississippi between 1850 and 1899 and entered the word cats. And I came up with something like 7.6 million hits, which I was shocked. And I thought, something's wrong here. I tend to be more of a dog person than a cat person. So I said, well, I'll check it out for dogs. So I did dogs, and it came back with 4.1 million hits. And I was just perplexed why cats were bigger newsmakers than dogs in the Old West. And I started looking, and I found out why. One, I think there were two surprises about it. One, cats were both necessities and nuisances in the Old West. Necessities for the rodent problem. And they were nuisances because they made so much noise at night that people just couldn't go to sleep. And they were absolutely hated because of that, because they disturbed all the night times. Remember, this is a time when you didn't have air conditioning. People slept at least in the spring and summer months and early fall with windows open and stuff. Cats are out cavorting and carousing, and they were just a pest. And I think the second surprise was that there were actually cat drives, that much like cattle drives, but particularly around mining towns and so forth, because they were so important to help with rodent control. Now, mm-hmm. Harriet can tell a little bit about one of her favorite stories, but people would throw things out windows, anything to try to chase and scare those cats away so they could sleep. So yeah, Harriet, you might talk about.
So there's stories of boys who decided maybe they could make a little money. And so they would be outside the window, open windows, and they would make noises like cats. And people would throw their projectiles. Favorite one was a boot jack, but hairbrushes, boot jacks, anything they could find near the bed would go out the window. The boys would collect this all the stuff and sell it the next day and make a little money.
Astounding. You know, we are great friends with a lot of Western songwriters and poets. And we've had some songs about dogs and some poems about dogs that I can think of. I can only think of a couple of cat songs, and they were kind of about cats and rodents, you know, and mice, or being cats themselves, kind of food for coyotes. Not necessarily cats the way you present them in these two books. So to our Western songwriter friends, you need to go do some research. There's a ton of great stories about cats.
Well, yeah, I uncovered an article from Deadwood, Dakota Territory, 1878, that said before they got cats in Deadwood at this one particular warehouse, that rodents were doing on average between $10 and $20 of damage to merchandise a day. Now you say, well, $10, $20, that's not much, but with inflation today, would equate to more than $300 to $600+ of damage. So they were a definite problem. And particularly in mining communities, because, well, first of all, mining communities primarily start out with men, so hygiene is not real good. It's a dirty work environment with lots of places for rodents to hide, and people are coming in from all over the world to try to get in on the boom, and sometimes they're bringing in new species of rats and mice and stuff, so they're just overwhelming. And there are lots of instances that I was able to document from the California Gold Rush all the way through the Gold Rush in the Yukon in the 1890s, where sharp entrepreneurs would make a killing. There was a barber in Los Angeles that at night he would collect cats, that stray cats, just trap them, not even buy them. And he shipped them on a schooner to San Francisco and sold them for $50 to $60 a piece. And every gold rush or silver rush or mining boom town had that. I spoke of Deadwood, probably the most famous cat drive, as I call it, was a fellow named Fatty Thompson out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. And he had kids collect cats, stray cats, and he paid them a nickel apiece. And then he took them to Deadwood and sold them for $50 to $75 each. His biggest customers were the girls of the Gulch, as the prostitutes of that time were known locally. It's a sort of known among Western historians as the cat for cat houses drive.
Well, and you talk about them being in post offices and at the mint, and you know, government in within a budget of a government office to keep, you know, the same because of paper, all of the things that rodents like. And to me, that was absolutely fascinating. These two books are just fantastic. I'm going to hold them up again. The first book is Cat Tales of the Old West, Poems, Puns, and Perspectives on Frontier Felines, and More Cat Tales of the Old West, Triumphs, Trials, and Trivia of Frontier Felines. And I would recommend, you really need them both. And you need them for you, and you need them for holiday gift giving. If there's any cat lover that you know, they will really enjoy these books. So what's next for you guys? What are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a historical novel for a spring release based on the Battle of Franklin on November 30th, 1864. And so that's going to be out. Right now it's targeted for May. So that's my individual project.
And together we're working on a sequel to Pint-Sized Pioneers. And this one will be called Pint-Sized Pioneers at Play, Homemade Frontier Fun and Danger. And it's slated for a fall release.
So you're all going to come back in the fall when you have both of those books out, right?
Yeah, we'd be glad to.
We'd love to.
Great.
And I just want to point out that Preston has a wonderful story in this new anthology called Through Western Storms. And this has a number of authors that we've had on the show, and we're working right now to schedule some for January and February. This is a phenomenal anthology. And we can't have Preston on and not mention it. So,
well, thank you. It was a fun story to write.
So, where can people find you?
Well, on Facebook, I can be found Preston Lewis Author, and my website is PrestonLewisAuthor.com, and then our publishing house where we have started publishing our own books is BarrisoPress.com.
There you go. Right.
That's really smart, Harriet.
Yeah, we like that.
I've got one too.
Yeah, there they are.
You got one too.
Yeah, they're very.
That show and tell is always good.
And they can always find the books on Amazon, or they can get them through our BarrisoPress.com.
Excellent.
So Jim has a little quote that we want to share. We're looking at our time. It's been so fun to have you with us.
Well, thank you. We've enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been great.
We have one from the book, but I got a little short one. I thought I'd check out Mark Twain, you know, because he talks about everything. And he says, a man who carries a cat by the tail learns something he can learn in no other way. Can you imagine how that cat would go for you? Okay, we have from the Daily Tombstone, Tombstone, Arizona, January the 23rd, 1886. Goodbye, Pussycat. An Auburn man recently cured his cat of getting upon the table in search of provender. He left some nitroglycerin in a saucer close to the edge of the table and poured a little milk on it, then went out and waited. As he peeked through the window, he saw the cat jump upon the table. He smiled. Soon the cat found the milk, and in drinking it, put its paw in the saucer. The man laughed aloud with glee. Then he heard a noise and slowly got up from a cornfield over the fence, picked several cords of splinters out of himself, and stared into the house to see how the cat felt. But was surprised when he found the cat had gone and taken the house with her.
Yep.
Okay,
it's a real story.
Cat tails and more cat tails. And Pint-Sized Pioneers, we're thanking our guests, Preston and Harriet, and our In the Limelight guest, Jan Payne, that was with us earlier with Rabbit Moon. Next week, our guest is, we have two, Mike Bray, co-founder of Wolfpack Publishing, is with us along with one of their authors. Peter Brandvold, and we'll be talking with Peter and Mike, and we'll be talking about these two books of Peter, another prolific author. I don't know, you Western writers, you just write and write and write. It's astounding.
How you doing?
You see how many books?
Well, it keeps us off the streets and out of jail.
So again, thank you so much to both of you and to Jan. Mm-hmm. We want to thank our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency, Clicks by Madison, and OutWestShop.com. Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio. You can find this episode 110 on Podbean probably tomorrow and still today on YouTube, Facebook, and LA Talk Radio's website. And do you have a parting comment?
First, thank you again. And the parting comment is, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing. We'll keep reading. We'll see you down the trail.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.